WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Tuesday edition of It's Your Turn. Hot fun in the summertime, huh? Yeah. It felt warm yesterday. I was kind of surprised. And when I got to work this morning and was checking the temperature chart, the high yesterday was only 83. And we really just kind of touched on that. We're already past that today, and we're headed into the upper 80s for the next couple of days, maybe three or four. So hang on. It's pretty hot. Ask the veterinarian today, later on the program. You may recall last week that President Donald Trump was in France at the invitation of the President of France, Emmanuel Macron. And the invitation was for a couple of reasons, a Bastille Day celebration, but that's a French holiday. It was also marking the 100th anniversary of America's entry into World War I. America did not get involved in World War I at the very beginning. In fact, we were in it for just 2 years, 1917 and 1918, but a tremendous loss of life. We'll talk about World War I today with the historian Richard Rubin, who will be joining us on the last segment of the program, talking about the last of the Doughboys. He, several years ago, started to research World War I with the idea of trying to find as many World War I veterans as he could. And he was able to interview quite a few. They have all since died. There are no living World War I veterans anywhere in the world, not only in the United States. But it's kind of a forgotten war sometime, 100 years ago. Yeah, that's coming up later. On tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about some of those new flights out of Pittsburgh. And that's kind of exciting, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, we'll be talking with Bob Kerlick, who is the Vice President of Media Relations for the Allegheny County Airport Authority. So if you're interested in that, WOW and Condor and Spirit and all those new airlines flying out of Pittsburgh, you want to be with us tomorrow. Also tomorrow, the Director of Butler VA Healthcare, David Cord, will be with us on tomorrow's program. Okay. With all of that preface material out of the way, let's say hi to a friend of long standing. Dr. Dennis Damon is here, veterinarian whose practice is at Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8 south of Butler. Dr. Damon, good to see you. Nice to have you back with us today.
Glad to be here on a day like today.
Hot day for us, and boy, hot day for the animals too. I hope we don't have to tell any pet owners not to leave their pets in the car, their dog or their cat, especially it seems like dogs. Don't even think about it, right?
Yeah, leave them at home right now. But I've seen people take them, and they're in the car. They got the window down 2 to 3 inches, but even 2 to 3 inches, there's not enough air circulating through your car. And if you're in the store for 15 minutes or so, if the dog gets stressed or excited and starts panting, definitely the inside of your car's temperature is different than the outside. It can elevate and cause some disasters with your pets. So
it's easily over 100 degrees. Hey, I don't have to tell you what your car's like when it's been sitting in the sun and you get in it. You can imagine if Fido is in there. And dogs don't sweat, right?
No.
They cannot
sweat. The
only
way they can really dissipate the heat is through their panting. And some dogs have the capabilities of ears helping a little bit, but the only way is panting, and if they're taking in hotter air than what their body is, then their temperature starts to rise.
Mm-hmm. So please, and I know people say, well, you know, my dog loves to ride in a car, and I'm just running into the store for 2 minutes. Well, you know, it's never 2 minutes, and it doesn't take very long before a dog can expire, really. This can very easily be fatal.
Mm-hmm. So it can happen within 5 to 10 minutes, too. I've seen it happen, so.
I saw there was a note in the, I think it was in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, a sign from a downtown area, a shopping area that I'd never seen before. There was a picture of it. It says, warning, dogs die in hot cars. In warm weather, don't leave your dog in the car. So, good reminder. I didn't say where what community that sign came from, but I'd never seen that before. Yeah. So, don't do it. Also, if your pets are, especially if they're outdoor animals, but anywhere really, plenty of fresh water this time of year. They drink it like crazy and they need it like crazy, right?
Yep, fresh, cool water. Not really freezing water, but you don't want them to drink in excess either, because that can cause another problem, which if they get too much water and the weight of the stomach with the water in there, their stomach can flip and cause bloat too. So frequent drinks as opposed to one drink and they get most of their water.
Mm-hmm. Are there any particular breed of dog that's more susceptible to that stomach flip thing?
Yeah, it's the barrel-chested ones. All dogs can get it, but more so with Labradors and St. Bernards, Great Danes, even our mutts that are Labrador crosses and things. But it's the barrel-chested, and if they drink or even if they eat and then start to go over and drink a lot and that food swells in there, then that stomach actually feels just uncomfortable, just like we get belly aches and stomach aches. And so then they may go out and roll, and then they flip their stomach, and then definitely within 30 minutes he has to get to somewhere where either you reflip the stomach or you have to have surgery done.
You can do that in some cases by manipulation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes you can put a tube down and release the gas before it totally flips all the way around. And I've had that happen. And sometimes I've flipped them the opposite direction that they turn, and I'm able to keep the stomach in place.
It's Ask the Veterinarian today. If you have any questions or concerns about your pet, feel free to give us a call. Phone number is 283-2525. Dr. Dennis Damon is here, 283-2525. Dr. Damon's practice is at Suburban Animal Clinic. It's about 5 miles south of Butler on Route 8. It's right at the intersection of Route 8 and Thorncrest Drive. As I say, it's about almost exactly five miles south of Butler. 283-2525 is our number. I saw warnings from health officials as far back as late winter that we could possibly have severe problems with ticks. So remind me to ask you about that as we get a little deeper into the program today. Let's take a call, 283-2525. Hello, this is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn with Dr. Damon.
Yes, I have a miniature schnauzer, and he has sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going through, he's up to 10 units twice a day now. And when he first got it, the doctor came out and he said he's got sugar, he's going to get cataracts, and he's going to go blind. Are you ready to deal with this? I asked him about taking the cataracts off. He said you can't take them off. Well, I just got done. I got an appointment Monday at Ohio University, and they say you could take them off and they won't come back.
Yes, you're correct to a certain degree. It depends on what's going on in the eye. I would never say 100% that they can be dealt with and things, but I will say that they can be removed, providing that the retina is in good shape, because generally the private practitioner doesn't have the light source that's needed to judge what's going on back in the retina.
So you need a specialist.
They generally have the scope that can go back in the back part of the eye and see exactly what the retina is doing and things before the surgery's done. because if you're not going to improve sight and it's still there, you might want to remove it because the aspect of glaucoma that can develop. But other than that, yes, you're correct in saying sometimes in about 70% of the animals, you can correct cataracts by getting them removed.
Are you thinking about doing that for your dog, sir?
Yes, I got an appointment Monday over at the University of Ohio for an evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, he, for a good while now, he's been bumping in. I was about to Ohio a couple of weeks ago. He's been calling, got a referral. But he bumps into stuff. He was falling down the steps and that. And, I mean, he's getting around, but he's still... bumps in. There's only a certain area he'll go in the yard. I take him somewhere else, he just freezes because I know he can't see where he's going.
Yeah. Well, but, yeah, and he doesn't have that area memorized either. Generally, if they've had sight for, how old's your dog?
He's seven.
Seven. So if they've had sight up to 5 years of age, they can eventually navigate. And I've had this even happen. People come in and I say, well, you know, I don't think your dog is blind, and they say, well, I really never knew that. And I say, well, does he bump into things or anything like that? And no, they say. And I say, yeah. Well, have you ever moved furniture and things? And they generally say no. So then if you remove something and put it in the way, his pathways that he follows, that he has by memory, he bumps into, crashes into things. So sometimes blindness escapes the owner simply because they never change things.
I'm a guessing, caller, that when you see this specialist at the university, they'll probably tell you whether or not, you know, the surgery can help your dog, because it's possible that it may not, you know.
I'm hoping that's what happens, but at times, I mean, he would ride with me in the truck, go to work with me and everything, and he would go crazy when he saw a kid on a bicycle or a jogger or something, you know, and every now and then, like, he'll be on the porch or he'll be in the truck with me, and I'm thinking he can get a little glimpse of something, because all of a sudden, he'll jump up and start barking as somebody's going down the road or something for a split second, and then, like, he loses view of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, gosh, we wish you the best when you see the specialist,
yes.
And they'll certainly give you the good advice. But as the doctor said, in some cases, not all, you can remove cataracts in dogs, and they'll be okay, but not all the time.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Well, sure. Best of luck to you.
Yeah, good question. Excellent question. Phone number is 283-2525 to ask the veterinarian, 283-2525. That caller brings up another good point. His dog's only 7 years old, which is not ancient for a dog.
Mm-mm.
But obviously sounds like a pretty significant case of diabetes. I don't know, 10 units
ten
a day.
10 units, twice a day. Yeah, that's getting up there for that a small... And I think he said a dachshund.
Schnauzer, miniature
schnauzer. Miniature schnauzer.
I only know because I wrote it down.
Schnauzers are common to get. I don't know why, but if I had to pick a breed, it would be schnauzers and dachshunds.
Very prevalent for diabetes.
For diabetes,
huh.
Yes.
How do you give insulin to a dog if you have a dog?
The same way you do people. You give it by injection, and generally, instead of giving it in the muscle, it goes sub-Q, which is right underneath the skin.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to give it twice a day, as long as it's a short-acting insulin. If it's a long-acting insulin, you can get that out to 24 hours or once a day, but that's a little bit harder to regulate to a certain degree as it is with twice a day. And then you have to kind of watch their feeding times. Mm-hmm. They can't be snacking and eating things outside their food time, which is a.m. and p.m., because you're actually causing the dog to eat carbohydrates. Most snacks, bones, things like that have large amounts of carbohydrate.
And that's turned into sugar.
And that's turned into sugar, and that can influence that sugar as far as trying to monitor it.
Are there special dog foods for dogs that
there
have
diabetes? There is. Hills makes some. Royal Canin makes some. Purina makes some. And they're a little bit better than the average food in the marketplace. However, we start with the foods in the marketplace and see if we can control them mm-hmm. With the owner doing it that way. But eventually, some of them will end up on the specialized diets, because with the specialized diet and the insulin, sometimes you can regulate them so that you stay low on the amount of insulin you give, because you're given a food that's known less in carbohydrates, higher in protein, and you can regulate those diets a little bit better than the ones on the marketplace.
So you said a Schnauzer is one of the breeds that's very susceptible to diabetes. Is, mm-hmm. is that more prevalent in smaller dogs? Hard to say.
I would say yes, but there are some dogs in the large breeds that get diabetes. But if I had to tell you in my practice, it's all generally small dogs. Schnauzers are very common. I got a lot of Schnauzers with diabetes, and then the next one to follow is the Dachshunds.
Hmm. We're talking to Dr. Dennis Damon of Suburban Animal Clinic. It's Ask the Veterinarian. If you have questions, comments, concerns about your pet, obviously, if you have any symptoms of illness or anything you're concerned about, or pet nutrition questions or pet behavior, that's fine, too. I saw, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago, I was actually driving through the city of Butler, and there was a lady, an older lady with a small dog. I'm not quite sure what kind it was. She was holding it. It was, a mm-hmm. pretty tiny dog.
Pocket pet.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. Obviously very devoted. I could just tell from the expression on her face. And I thought, wow, it's a wonderful feeling to have a pet, but by the same token, when you lose a pet, it's got to be tough,
mm-hmm.
Especially for an elderly person. Do large breed dogs tend to have a longer lifespan than the little ones, or is that
actually it's the opposite? The
really?
Little ones have a little bit longer lifespan than the large ones, simply because of the metabolic rate and things going on. But I would say longevity you got to give to the little guys.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is very difficult to deal with pet when it comes time to let them go and things, and grieving and things. We as a society have now incorporated the dog into family members as opposed to just a dog and it's out chained and mm-hmm. we have it for security, barking and things like that. Now they've become more of a family pet, and hence comes the problem of what to do, when to do it safely. You don't want your dog to suffer, those type of things. So it ends up really a choice of number one, trying to educate the client to make sure that the five bodily functions actually still go on, which mm-hmm. is eating, drinking, sleeping, getting around well without any problems, and activity-wise, once they become a vegetable, they go to a corner, they just lay, you have to get them up, You have to carry them outside, do their bathroom chores and things. As long as you, as an individual, can put up with that, there's nothing wrong with keeping the animal going. But you've also got to look at it from the animal standpoint, from the human side, too, mm-hmm. is that if you were there and you suddenly got a problem and you got put in a wheelchair and you couldn't really do anything, you're limited in what you do and things like that, not to profess that you should be put to sleep, but you know what you feel like, and you're kind of on a useless basis. And
of course, the pain, you can't, your dogs,
right.
can't, they can't talk to you.
And the pain tolerance of animals is way above your threshold anyway. Mm-hmm. And so you can't even register the fact that, you know, is your dog in pain or not? Generally, at an older age with arthritis there, and the decrease in eating and things, there's got to be some discomfort and pain going on. So it's really an evaluation by the family to know when time is good. And with some good education, veterinary and advice, I think you can make your decision without any grief.
So talk to your veterinarian about this.
Yes.
Right, if you have concerns.
Yes. But, you know, if you anybody else, like friends and things that come over, they're not automatically going to tell you, put the animal to sleep, he's really suffering. Well, they're not attached. Mm-hmm. And so if they have the attachment and things, they could be voicing an opinion. But I don't think an outsider can really voice a good opinion because of the family attachment.
And your veterinarian would understand that, that's for sure. Phone number is 283-2525. It is Ask the Veterinarian today. Dr. Dennis Damon is with us here in the studio. 283-2525 is the number. I saw a picture in the paper. I'm not sure. It was within the past couple of weeks. It was a guy with his cat sitting on a table. And I thought, boy, that's like a big cat. And the caption just said, here's whatever his name was, Joe, with his 26-pound cat. That's awful big for a cat, isn't it? 26 pounds?
Considering that the average cat weighs between 7 and 12 pounds, you can see that cat is about 26, so maybe 50 to 60% overweight. And he didn't get that way yesterday. He got that way over time, and cats are different than dogs. Cats get fat because they're lazy. Mm-hmm. And we as family members don't really provide them with a lot of activity, so they either sit on the arm of your chair, go and look out the window at Mr. Tweety outside, come back, go over, eat, come back, lay in the chair, groom themselves, and that's about it that cats do. So they don't get a lot of exercise. Now, when they're kittens, up to about 2 years of age, they do get a lot of exercise because they become, they're really active, curiosity, everything.
They pounce. Kittens pounce all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes one cat in the household is a bad problem because he's the only cat, so he's bored. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing to do, so he just eats, sleeps, and that's it. And there are little toys and things now that they get to exercise these cats and things, and lights that go on the wall that the cats chase and things, and sometimes you can provide them with exercise 3 times a day. And you got to start it early, though, because once your cat's 26 pounds and then you say, oh my gosh, I got to get him exercise and things like that, it's just like an old you can't teach an old animal new tricks. They're sedentary and they're set in their ways.
Phone number is 283-2525. If you have questions or comments for the good doctor, he's with us here in the studio, 283-2525. Let's take another call. Hi, this is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn with Dr. Damon.
Hi, Dave, and hi, Dr. Damon. I have a question about a cat in a litter box.
Mm-hmm.
If you're having problems with your cat using a litter box, and it's not that the litter box is dirty, it's kept very clean, because I know they're real funny about the litter box. Do you have any suggestions on what to do about that?
Well, can you tell us how old your cat is, first of all?
The cat that I have, it was given to me by a family member. It's an older cat.
Okay.
And it's a calico, and she's very aloof anyway. She's not in, doesn't like people, only likes, like, myself. And I have other cats, but she's in a separate place of the house that they're not near her.
Mm-hmm.
They don't go anywhere near her, and she's really like the only one, and she likes to be by herself.
Is this mm-hmm. a new problem that she's not
older? No, this has been a recurring problem off and on. She is older. I'm going to say probably about 13, maybe 14.
Did it start shortly after you got her?
It quit for a long time. And then it's starting up again.
Yeah. It probably is a combination of behavioral stress. There might be even a possibility of some sort of infection or crystals. What you should do is your veterinarian should ask for a urine sample if he can obtain it through you. If not,
okay.
Sometimes you can get them in the exam room when you examine the animal, and you check the urine first of all for any type of bacteria, infection, crystals, and things like that, which can influence the part of your cat's going to the bathroom in the litter. Second of all, you've already kind of alluded to one of the problems, and that is she's an independent cat, wants to stay to herself, so she knows other cats are in the household. So she's probably got a stress note in there. For the fact that she may go outside the urinal or the cat litter, because you've already, I'm pretty sure it's not a cleanliness problem, because you said mm-hmm. you keep it clean. I've had where you put or buy a cat litter, and you put a hood over it so that the cat can go in there, and he's completely isolated in there, and he feels very comfortable in there, as opposed to a litter box that's just open.
Wow, never heard of that.
Sometimes that can help you. Behavior-wise, any sounds, any disruptions, things like that have occurred while she's in the urinal area can influence her peeing and cause her to go outside the litter.
Mm-hmm.
And then behavioral. And there are certain medications that you can try over a period of 30 to 90 days to see if you can get the cat to kind of switch back where he or she will go in the litter basket itself.
Do you keep her all in one room all the time, caller?
Yes, she is in one room. She won't come out of that room.
Mm-hmm.
And she had came from another state. They had lived in Colorado.
I see.
And she came here, and she acted the same way up there. But I know this cat has had a lot of stress, because she had a brother that got hit by a car, and those two were like, stuck together. They were completely always together.
Mm-hmm.
I know there has been a lot of stress and a lot of issues. I'm just wondering, you know, what you could possibly do for that. But it just seems like we must go through periods of stress and then these issues must happen.
The other thing that occurs to me, and this is Dave talking, I'm not obviously a veterinarian, but I might be a little bit concerned about the age of your cat. Did you say she was 13 or 14?
Yeah, she's older.
Mm-hmm.
She's
still set in her ways, too.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want this to become a fixed behavior because it can happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I would discuss the possibility of using Prozac, providing that the urine comes up negative for most of the like blood, leukocytes, white blood cells there, and also that there's no crystals or anything like that that's evident in the stool. And if all that is negative, I would probably, if I was the attending veterinarian, I would ask you if we could try a test trial of a drug that is known as Prozac.
It's a stress reliever, is that what that does?
And it helps to kind of change their behavior just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had many, many cats, not 100%, but I would say in the neighborhood of 60 to 70% that have reverted back to going in the urine. And then sometimes you can take them off of it and they will do fine. But then if they revert, then you should definitely continue the medicine consistently. Sometimes while I tell the owners, you can take them off, but it may not work the second time around as good well as the first time around. If it's working, why change something that's working?
Right. Why change it?
Good idea to talk about that with your veterinarian. There's an idea for you anyway, Colin.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dr. Dane.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you
very much.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
Good questions. Thank you. Thanks a lot. 283-2525 is our number. It's Ask the Veterinarian today. Sounds like we have a pet right there, yes. Hello, caller. This is Dave. You're on the air. Go right ahead with Dr. Damon. Hello? Okay. I guess they couldn't hear us there. I thought that was just like a dog barking. I don't know, in the background. 283-2, maybe they couldn't hear us for Fido. 283-2525 is our number. 283-2525. Hi, caller. This is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead. It's your turn with
Hi.
Dr. Damon.
Hi, Dr. Damon.
Hi.
Can you tell me that exotic birds should be in a dark, hot place, especially when they're sleeping or whatever?
Well, they should have something put over the cage to make sure that, you know, there's a light change difference. You don't want them just to be open to the surroundings. So most of the time I have people make a 3/4 inch curtain sort of, or a bag or whatever you could say, that you can place down over the cage to help create a safe environment. Not that your house is not safe and things, but it is a little bit more secure and safe for the bird.
They feel safer anyway, huh?
Right.
Yeah.
And then also, you can buy these little, they're not really stuffed, but they're kind of what they call buddies. It looks like a little bear or a little animal of some sort that's small enough that you can put in the corner of the cage and next to put a mirror there and then the buddy on the other side of the mirror and make sure that he has a rung that goes over there. And sometimes they will kind of move to the little buddy and stay there overnight. And they kind of adapt that as their security area.
That is fascinating. Have you had trouble with your bird collar?
No, but I was wondering, after you put a cover on it, how do you ventilate the cage?
Well, I said a three-quarter. No, I didn't say total. So the air will still circulate in underneath there.
Oh, I didn't understand either. So you want the curtain to only come down like
about three quarters
of the way down.
Yeah.
Okay, I got it.
And it doesn't have to be a bag. It could be, you could have it slit. And, of course, cloth is permeable to air, so you don't even have to worry about the fact that even if you use a total drape, air is still going to get through. But you can, at the very top, make a hood, and then the sides just kind of hang down a little bit, and they be open a little bit. But definitely you can create an environment for that little bird or big bird that he will feel safe in.
There's some good tips for you, my friend.
I understand. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thanks for the call. Good question. Take another call here, 283-2525. Ask the veterinarian, 283-2525. Caller, thanks for waiting. Now, this is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn with Dr. Damon.
Hello, doctor.
Mm-hmm.
My name's Jennifer. I have a cat that is about 13, 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And always ate dry cat food, had no health problems or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the past year, she has been losing a lot of weight. She had originally weighed about 13 pounds. I bet you right now she's down to 3 or 4 pounds.
Ooh.
Wow.
Yes.
That's
And she's eating things that she never ate before.
Yeah. You need to see your veterinarian. And and have him do a chemistry with a thyroid tied into it, and see if your cat is hyperthyroid. Because if he is, he's always doing is eating up himself, which means he's living off his own protein, and that's muscle. And if he's gone from the extreme to 3 to 4 pounds, it would shake my tree up a little bit with my client. I'd be checking some things out because there are some other things. That's why you'd do a full chemistry. Kidney disease, all those things can influence diabetes, another area that should be investigated, though your other complaint should have been that he sat the water bowl a lot. But I'd definitely get him looked at by your veterinarian and see what's ticking as far as his internals, because you can help him. But you need to get it done quickly. Otherwise, the longer you wait, the more extreme the process gets.
Yeah, it sounds like that could be a serious problem, so better get it checked out, okay?
Okay, I will. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and I'm sure she understands we can't get too specific because you're not looking at the animal, but it sounds like that could be a serious thing.
Oh,
so.
Especially if they lose 50% of their weight in 1 year.
Yeah,
that is very serious.
Take another call, 283-2525. Hello, caller, are you still there? I thought I heard that caller hanging up, 283-2525. We need to take a break anyway, so let's do that. If you have questions, comments, ask the veterinarian, 283-2525, here on It's Your Turn on WISR, and we will be back right after these words. We are speaking with physical medicine and rehabilitation specialist Dr. Edward Reedy from Tri Rivers Surgical. Dr. Reedy, what types of neurological conditions do you treat?
We would often see patients with simple neurologic conditions such as carpal tunnel syndrome or pinched nerves of the arm, and we'll occasionally see patients with more serious neurologic disorders such as a stroke or brain injury. the treatment for the more serious aspects of these usually involves a fair amount of testing and often hospitalization, whereas the treatment for the more simpler neurologic disorders is usually done on an outpatient basis with medications to fight inflammation and occasionally simple surgical procedures.
To learn more, call Tri-Rivers Surgical at their new office near the Clearview Mall in Butler, toll-free 866-874-7483. That number again is 866-874-7483.
Great vacation idea you might want to think about, available through Butler Motor Tours. And this is in mid-September, and it's a six-day trip down south. Amelia Island, South Carolina, beautiful place, down to St. Augustine, Florida. Stop at Savannah, a tour of the Paris Island Marine Base along the coast. Nice, huh? Yeah, September 10th through 15th. You know, when you travel with Butler Motor Tours, it's a convenient and affordable way to travel. It's fun, of course. Very convenient. And yes, it's affordable. Yeah. By the way, if you like the South, Outer Banks are taking a trip down there, too, in the last couple of days of August, early September. North Carolina and the Outer Banks. Lots of other trips, too, on into the autumn, including fall foliage cruises and train trips, New England, West Virginia, Butler Motor Tours. Check them out online. All their trips are there. It's a wonderful website. It's butlerbus.com. Pretty easy to remember, right? butlerbus.com. South Monroe Street in Butler, a local company, taking people to faraway places for 77 years now. Butler Motor Tours online at butlerbus.com. Right back to the phones we go. Ask the Veterinarian, 283-2525. Hi, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn with Dr. Damon.
Okay, hi, Dave. Hi, Dr. Damon.
Howdy.
My daughter has, she has a dog. It's about 5 years old. And lately, when you see him and he gets excited, then he gets real excited and it's like he's gasping for air. Like when he's...
You know, if he gets excited and things, one of the things excitement brings is stress. So the automatic phase of the dog is to start to pant. Now, what kind of a dog is it?
He's a Maltese.
Yeah, and so you got the smudged-in nose, meaning that he's not a German Shepherd-like dog that has the tapered mouth. Everything's kind of smudged in, and when he becomes excited... and stressed, so does he start to pant. And then as he pants, the tongue swells, then he can start to do that gagging reflex or cough, you might say, or
yeah,
whatever.
That's exactly
how
it is.
And so you try to either take him out of stressful conditions where he doesn't do that. Most of the time, you don't really have too much of a problem with it. But you do have to worry about the fact that with the shortness of the nose and everything compact and things, you don't want him to continue to sort of gasp, because in warm areas, he has that ability to start taking in warm air. Because the only way they got to cool themselves is through that panting aspect. And if you don't control the avenue of air and coolness, then it shortly can cause some temperature rise and some of the other problems. So you want to kind of move him to a cool area and take him out of the stress.
What brings this on? Somebody else coming into the room or coming into the house or what?
Well, usually, like if he, say if I go visit him and he gets real excited.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes down and then, like he'll, like he said, he'll like start patting and then it'll sound like he can't catch his breath.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'll have a little bit of,
coughing
with it.
I've seen that. It's pretty common, isn't it, when a new person comes into the house or comes into a room.
Dogs get excited.
Dogs start jumping around.
How old is he?
Fred's five.
Five. Yeah, he should be able to control his excitement phase where he doesn't put him into a life-threatening position at 5 years of age.
Yeah.
But sometimes you do have to remove him from the stressed area and get him into a quiet room and get it cool either by fan or air conditioner.
Well, there's some tips for you anyway.
Okay, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Good questions.
Bye.
Thanks a lot. I've seen that quite a bit, and it is difficult to calm some dogs down. I mean, they just they almost go bonkers, you know.
When that happens. Especially excitable dogs and completely friendly. They start to immediately start to pant, and that's just their greeting way. But most of the dogs... if you kind of have the visitor or whatever the excitement area, kind of push him away a little bit or quiet him down, they'll control it. That's the reason why if you can't control it by being in the room with whatever caused the excitement, then you just remove him from those circumstances and let him get into a cool area. Where he can become adjusted and back to normal.
So a dog with a long snout, which we don't think of. I mean, we think of it as a long jaw, but it's a long nose too, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So they have
More room to move air, and they're not as compact in the back of the throat area as like bulldogs and Boston Terriers
or Maltese.
Their noses start to be shoved back into their head there. Mm-hmm. So all that you have on the German Shepherd, if you just kind of cram it back in there, is all in the throat and area. And if it swells and things, there's just kind of a not enough room for air and everything else with the phlegm. That's coming from the excitement phase, and it becomes frothy because he's panting and things, and then it gets in the back of the throat area, then he starts to sputter.
One thing leads to another. Well, I know humans, when you breathe through your nose, you're either warming or cooling air, depending on whether you're outdoors in January or outdoors in July. That's what. When you breathe through your nose, the air passes those passages and it acts as a radiator of sorts, you know,
right.
Temperature control. Listen, I want to make sure, our phone number, folks, is 283-2525. Ask the veterinarian today, Dr. Dennis Damon here from Suburban Animal Clinic. I want to make sure and ask you about ticks because we got word even late winter. It was a mild winter, obviously. Almost the entire winter, extremely mild, and there were worries from health officials that the tick problem was going to be significantly worse this spring and summer. Have you noticed any evidence of that at your practice, Dr. Damon?
Well, yes, I have. Already this year, we've lost 18 dogs to Lyme's disease.
Fatal.
Wow. It's not a significant number with the fact that if you look at the total number of clients that we're seeing, but it is a significant number in the sense that from one disease, Lyme's disease can cause some problems, and that's once it attacks the kidneys and things, kidney destruction, it's very difficult and almost impossible to control, whereas all the other aspects of what Lyme's causes, pain or limited movement, the animal not feeling good, we can get the animal negative by treating him with some medication, but this kidney disease is very fatal. My suggestion is that people really consider getting their dog tested and see if he is positive for Lyme's. And sometimes they'll be positive for Lyme's, and yet There's nothing wrong with your dog.
No symptoms.
No symptoms yet. Hmm. But he has Lyme's on board, which means that the disease exists in your dog, and all it's doing is waiting for a stress period or some sort of influential period to start to overtake that dog. Now, it might take a year. That might take several years. But the duty is of you, and the responsibility, and the veterinarian, is to see to the fact that there's nothing there that can cause some problems. And if there is, then you treat for it to try to keep him from getting it.
Now, I know that there's a vaccine for dogs against Lyme's disease, and from what I understand, it's pretty effective. But if your dog's already been exposed, if you...
You still can vaccinate. Yeah. But you have to take a couple of steps that you don't take when the dog has not Lyme's disease. And that is, number one, is if your dog's positive and not showing any signs, you can, number one, check the urine and see if there's any protein being lost in the urine.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing it can be on. And then the second thing is another testing for the titer of the disease. And normal is 10 to 30. Outside that, your dog can be in jeopardy. So the idea of the treatment is to bring that titer down to within the limits there.
That's like a marker in the blood or
anything.
That is? Okay.
So if you're treating the disease and trying to bring down the titer and everything, you still can vaccinate. And the vaccinations is good for future infections, mm-hmm. not the present infection. And it has to be done yearly. And you have to keep up with it. And you also have to use some external means of keeping your animal free of ticks.
So even if I get my dog vaccinated,
you still have to look for ticks? You still have to look for ticks and get them off there as soon as possible. The tick bites the animal, and the organism comes through the tick, through the saliva, into your dog, and that process takes about 72 hours.
Okay.
So if your dog didn't have a tick where you were looking and this morning, but you removed it this evening, I would not give a really big concern. But you had to know that it wasn't there. If it was there, then 30 days from the time you remove that tick, you should have him tested, as opposed to testing the day that you remove the tick, because you can test him, he's negative, but in 30 days he becomes positive, simply because that tick's been on there longer than 48 to 72 hours.
I got you. So this is really... If your dog's outside, most dogs are, quite frankly, if nothing else, to take care of their routine business a couple of times a day. They're in the grass. For dog owners, checking for ticks is almost a never-ending battle,
right.
Isn't it?
And then the other thing is, even though you check for ticks, there's actually three stages of ticks. There's the nymph, larva, and then the tick itself. So each one of the stages can cause Lyme's disease because it's there in the tick, and they need to suck blood to move on to their next phase. And so the nymph and larva are generally pretty small, and you're very hard-pressed to ever see them. If you look at the period at the end of the sentence on your newspaper, That's what the nymph and larva actually size of it is. And then when you look at the tick, you can actually see the tick because that's the adult. And he's swelling or she's swelling up with blood. Generally, if he swells with blood, it's a female. If it's a tick that's not swelling with blood, it probably is a male.
Do you? Is it just a visual check? Do you use one of those micro?
No, you just run your hands on your animal and check his legs, and you're just checking for any adults.
Okay. So you would feel them.
Yeah. And then, as far as the nymphs and larvae, you're probably not going to catch them. And
too small, can't see them.
Right. Yeah. So that's the reason why I would recommend, number one, have them tested. See if they're negative. If they're negative, get the vaccine on board. If that's all you do, that's more than what you really were doing. But there's one further step that you have to institute on a year-to-year basis, and that's protection from the tick on the animal, which is either using some of the topicals or there's a collar out that protects your animal for 8 months and takes you out of the equation.
If you had this vaccine's pretty effective, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you had your dog vaccinated, got the anti-tick vaccine, and then we're using like a collar, could you feel pretty confident
that's all you do with my pets. And I take them up to my cottage, and there's ticks galore up there. Very seldom do I ever see a tick on my dog, but I see occasionally, and I remove them. But I don't really get excited because I knew that the tick wasn't there in the morning. And then the other thing is what I do with my animals versus what you as a pet owner should do is I test my dogs every year in and around Christmas and see if the vaccine's holding, if everything's working the way it should be, and for the last 8 years, they've come up negative every year.
Yeah, that's pretty good plan then for dog owners. And thank goodness we have a vaccine that's effective for
they're working on it for people. It's not perfected yet, but the vaccine definitely in animals does work.
Dr. Dennis Damon visiting with us today. Dr. Damon's practice is at Suburban Animal Clinic. It's on Route 8 South. It's almost exactly 5 miles south of Butler at the intersection of Route 8 and Thorncrest Drive. And if you're going south from Butler toward Pittsburgh, the easiest way to know you're there is when you pass the last of the auto dealerships there. Start looking. If you're headed south, it will be on your left-hand side as soon as you get past the... what's the last one there?
The Chevrolet and Deal.
And Deal. Yeah, those are the last two.
We're about 7/10 of a mile south of them.
Mm-hmm. Suburban Animal Clinic. Dr. Damon, good to see you.
Thank you.
Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. More to come on It's Your Turn. We'll take a quick break here. As you know, President Donald Trump was in France just last week, just a few days ago, as a matter of fact. It was the latter part of last week at the invitation of the President of France, Emmanuel Macron. And the President was there for two things. He was celebrating Bastille Day, which is a big holiday in France, kind of like their Independence Day, but also marking the 100th anniversary of the United States' entry into World War One. And we're going to talk about World War One coming up on the next segment of the program with the historian and writer Richard Rubin. 100 years ago, the United States was not involved in World War One at the beginning of the war. We were in it actually for only 2 years, 1917 and 1918, still at tremendous loss of life. What do you know about World War One? Probably most folks know a lot more about World War Two than World War One, right? There's not as much written about it. Well, it's 100 years, 100-year anniversary of our entry. We'll talk about that, and we'll talk with Richard Rubin, who made it a project some years ago, and he began researching this book. He wanted to try to locate and interview surviving World War One veterans, and he was able to find some several years ago. They have all since passed away. Now, there aren't any more World War I veterans alive. So thank goodness Reuben was able to do this. We'll talk to him. It's coming up next here on the It's Your Turn program, right after a couple of messages for you. One of them is from a new sponsor on our program. You probably heard us talking about them. It's Going Postal Butler. This is a local company that does a very, very needed service. They package items for shipping. And this could be a real bag, quite frankly, right? When you got to mail something, because it's not something we do every day. For most of us, we don't do it much at all, really. And so maybe you don't have the stuff, the wrapping paper, there are suggestions for wrapping things for shipping. You have to do it. I mean, you just can't put it in a paper bag. There's recommended tape and string and all that kind of labels. They've got all of that for you at Gone Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center. They will package your items for shipping, and they'll ship them any way you want. FedEx, UPS, United States Postal Service. They're located at 140 Shockey Lane. That's right behind King's and Villa Grande restaurants, right off Newcastle Road. You know where that is, right? King's, Villa Grande. They're in the Shockey mini storage. Call them to get more information on their services, because they do other stuff too besides shipping. They have copying service, scanning, faxing, mailbox rentals, custom boxes, greeting cards, even a lottery agent. Oh, yeah, and an official notary as well. 140 Shockey Lane, right behind King's and Villa Grande off Newcastle Road. Phone them at 724-841-0044. 724-841-0044. Your friendly neighborhood shipping center, that's Going Postal Butler. The Musical Theater Guild of Butler presents its summer show, The Hilarious and Wonderful Nonsense. Show performances July 14, 15, 16, and 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. The Friday and Saturday night performances are at 7:30. The Sunday matinees at 3. All shows at the William A. Leonard Performance Hall, the MTG Production Center at the far end of Butler Memorial Park. Don't miss Paula Baptiste, Tammy Erkman, Holly Furman, Chris Lilly, and Samantha Roth in Nonsense, the summer show of the Musical Theater Guild of Butler. Buy tickets online at mtgbutler.org or by phone at 28-STAGE. Welcome, listeners. Boy, I've been looking forward to this interview for some time. We're going to be chatting on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR by telephone with Richard Reuben. And we're going to be talking about World War I, specifically Richard's book, The Last of the Doughboys. Richard Reuben, nice to meet you. It's a pleasure to be able to talk with you for the next few minutes here today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
When I mentioned to some of the folks around the radio station the last day or so that I was going to be chatting with you, the almost universal reaction was, yeah, you're right, because I had mentioned the subtitle of your book, The Last of the Doughboys, The Forgotten Generation and Their Forgotten World War. And I say that by no means to minimize World War II, but that's been where all the recent publicity has been. The ton of books, the films, the HBO specials, the interviews and so on, and rightly so, for goodness sakes. But, you know, you stop people in the street these days, and I dare say there wouldn't be too many people who could tell you very much about World War I.
No, that's true, and it's especially striking, first of all, considering how enormous the war was and how many Americans died in it, 117,000 or so. But also, you know, in the years after the war ended in 1918, people thought it extremely important that that war be remembered and the people who fought it be remembered. And there are more monuments to World War I in this country than any other war. I can't tell you how many towns I've been to all over the country that don't have a Civil War monument or a World War II monument, but do have a World War I monument. So it's especially striking to me that the war has been forgotten to the extent that it has.
We are in the town of Butler. It's a suburb of Pittsburgh. We're about 25, 30 miles north of Pittsburgh. And yes, we have a small park in our city called Doughboy Park, with a World War I era cannon and a statue of a doughboy.
Yes, and really everywhere you go, it's very hard to find a town that that was around in 1918 that doesn't have something memorializing World War One. It's really quite striking.
By the way, before we go any further, and I promised several listeners that I'd ask you this, are you familiar with the origination of the term doughboy? Do you know where that comes from and what that means?
That is disputed. There are lots of theories. The two most popular ones are, some people say it goes back to the Mexican War in the 1840s. A group of American infantrymen were seen marching through dusty Mexican terrain and coated in dust, and somebody remarked that they looked like they'd been rolled in a flour.
Hmm.
And the other leading theory is that donuts became very, very popular during World War One for the first time. The Salvation Army volunteers went over to France and set up little canteens serving coffee and donuts to very grateful soldiers over there. So those are the two leading theories, but nobody really knows for sure.
You, about 10 years ago, decided that you were going to try to talk to some of the veterans who were still alive from World War One, and it's my understanding that it took you some time to find even one that you could talk to. Is that correct?
Yes, it took several months. It was actually a very frustrating process. At first, I had imagined that there would be a central database of living World War One veterans, possibly at the Department of Veterans Affairs or somewhere else, and there was no such thing. And I took to calling VA hospitals and nursing homes and American Legion posts and VFW posts, and nobody had seen a World War One veteran in a long time. And everybody always said, well, let us know if you find any.
Hmm.
In fact, I had originally set out to just maybe interview two or three and do an article about it, but it took so long to find even one that I got really mad and decided I was going to go ahead and find them all.
And you did.
Well, I wouldn't say necessarily that I found them all, but I certainly found, I would say, close to all who were still living. I had hoped to find two or three starting out, and in the end I interviewed dozens.
And they ranged in age at that time. They were all over 100, right?
That's right. The youngest person I interviewed was 101, and the oldest was 113.
They have all now since died, of course.
That's right. The last American World War One veteran, Frank Buckles, died in February of 2011 at the age of 110. And in fact, there aren't any living World War One veterans anywhere in the world at this point.
It must give you some satisfaction then to have come up with the germ of the idea for this book, Richard, and then be able to accomplish it while these last few remaining veterans were still alive and you were able to talk to them. Nobody can duplicate that anymore.
No, they're all gone, and they're never coming back. And I was very fortunate to have started when I did. When you think about that 2003 was 85 years after the armistice, I really did get started at the last possible moment.
Some folks will know, some of our listeners will know this, others will not. We celebrate Veterans Day in November each year. And the reason that Veterans Day is celebrated on that date is, in fact, the armistice that ended World War One, correct?
That's right. It was known as Armistice Day until, I believe, 1954, when the name was changed to Veterans Day in order to honor all veterans. But that's why, unlike Memorial Day, which is the last Monday in May, Veterans Day is always celebrated on November 11th, because the war ended, as everyone knows, at 11 a.m. precisely on November 11th, 1918.
We're talking, for listeners who may have joined us a few minutes late on this segment of It's Your Turn, we're chatting with Richard Rubin, author of The Last of the Doughboys, The Forgotten Generation and Their Forgotten World War. And, of course, it's World War One. You have a raft of pictures, Richard, in your book. And the first one that I came to, in fact, it's the first picture, one of the veterans, Anthony Pereiro. I was astonished to look at him. He was 107 when the photograph of him was taken. He could easily pass for 75 or 80. He looked very young.
this was something that was true of everybody I interviewed. You know, I set out, I don't think I'd actually met a centenarian before I undertook this project, and I had no idea what to expect. But in fact, everybody I interviewed looked significantly younger than they were. Some of them looked 3 decades younger than they were. And you quickly come to understand, I took a crash course really in gerontology, the study of aging, in the process of doing this book, and you come to understand that people who live to be 107 are different than the rest of us, really from birth, genetically. They're different than we are, and they age more slowly than we do. It was really startling at first. You get used to it after a while, but it of course is one of the wonderful things about the experience that you quickly forget when you're talking to a 107-year-old man. If he's telling you good stories, you forget that he's 107.
You also, in almost all cases, have a photograph of the veteran as you talk to him, and then a photograph of him during his service years in his uniform, and those are marvelous to compare. In fact, the great bulk of your book, Richard, is the interviews that you were able to do with these veterans. Did you meet them in their homes? Were they more than willing to talk to you and share their stories?
Yeah, for the most part, I did interview them in their homes, and or if they lived in a residential facility, I interviewed them. A couple of folks lived in long-term wings in hospitals, and I went to them. Obviously, you don't ask a 106-year-old man to or woman to come to you, and they were very, very open to being interviewed and eager. Much more, I have to say, than I had a right to expect at first. I mean, I have to tell you that if I were 107 years old and some guy I'd never heard of, whom I didn't know anything about at all, asked me if he could come talk to me for a few hours about my experiences in something that ended 85, 86 years ago, I might be a little too aware of how few hours I might have left to just hand a few over to this person.
Mm-hmm.
And that was never, ever the case with any of these folks. They were always very happy and eager to talk to me. Now, I will say that not everybody I found I was able to go interview. In some cases, the families didn't want them to be interviewed. But in the overwhelming majority, they were happy to talk to me, and not just to talk to me, but I would say that in all the interviews I did, hundreds and hundreds of hours of conversation, I heard the equivalent of, I don't want to talk about it, exactly once.
Hmm. Well, that's in somewhat stark contrast. Perhaps it's the length of time that had passed since World War One, you know, 80-some years, because I have read countless stories and, in fact, have personally witnessed World War II veterans who were extremely hesitant to talk about their experiences up until just a few years ago.
Well, that's what you expect, and that's certainly understandable. And it's occurred to me, too, that maybe it was because it had been 85 years. But, you know, I have to say also that a couple of things. First of all, everybody I interviewed, with one really notable exception, was really, really stoic about their lives and their experiences, and nothing was a big deal to them. One of the first people I interviewed who'd been in combat longer than pretty much anybody else in the American Expeditionary Forces told me that he got gassed all the time, and I asked him, well, what was that like? Because you hear horrible stories about what gas did to people in World War One, and he said, well, you know, it wasn't a big deal. I just lost my voice for a few days, and I never went to medical for it or anything like that. And that really kind of set the stage for what people were like. They were they didn't hold back. They told you what happened, but they were very, very stoic about it. And the other thing is that talking to them, they often mention the fact that they hadn't talked about these things in 50, 60, 70 years. And sometimes I got bold and asked them why not, and often the response was just nobody'd asked. They didn't have a problem talking about it, but nobody seemed interested. And indeed, you know, a lot of these people lived in small towns, and yet nobody in those towns seemed to be aware that there was a 108-year-old man or woman living in that town who had served in World War One, and that was really, you know, really shocking to me.
We'll take a quick break. We have a little bit more time to chat with our guest. He is Richard Rubin, author of The Last of the Doughboys, The Forgotten Generation, and Their Forgotten World War. We'll take a quick break. Resume our conversation here on It's Your Turn on WISR in just a couple of minutes.
For more than 130 years, the name Concordia has meant quality care. Today, Concordia Visiting Nurses has provided high-quality, skilled nursing and a variety of therapy services to people in and around our community. Concordia Visiting Nurses is here to foster your recovery right in your own home. If you're in need of home health care, choose Concordia Visiting Nurses. Call toll-free at 1-877-352-6200.
Do you know our air traffic control system still tracks flights with radar and paper strips? Your cell phone GPS is more advanced. Modernizing our air traffic control means shorter routes, more direct flights, and less fuel burn, so it's better for the environment and your vacation plans. The Air Traffic Controllers Union and the Airline Pilots Association support it, but Congress is blocking modernization. Take action. Tell Congress to bring our air traffic control into the 21st century at ontimeflights.org. Paid for by Citizens for On-Time Flights.
Welcome back, listeners. If you're joining us a little bit late on this segment of It's Your Turn, welcome. Dave Malarkey is my name. Our guest visits with us by telephone today. He is Richard Rubin, author of The Last of the Doughboys, The Forgotten Generation and Their Forgotten World War. And, of course, we're talking about World War One. And Richard was able to locate and talk with several dozen World War One veterans, starting about 10 years ago when he began his research. And as we mentioned during the first part of our conversation, all of those individuals have now passed away. So there'll be no one else who's able to talk to them and write their stories. And you write a lot of stories, Richard. Can you pick out a couple of interesting ones that may pique people's interest to read more?
Well, gosh, there are so many. There was the gentleman I was mentioning earlier who... as I said, served in combat longer than just about anybody else in the war, and he really had a front row seat to pretty much everything the American Expeditionary Forces did in France for the whole time that they were there. He was really a remarkable man. I saw him several months after I first met him. I saw him ride in his small town's Veterans Day parade. And if you think about the fact that this was 85 years to the day after the armistice, he was still riding in parades. That was really something to see. The first fellow I interviewed, Anthony Piero, who you mentioned earlier, he served in an artillery battery, and one of the things he kept coming back to again and again was how many close calls he'd had and how his life had been saved unexpectedly, in one case by a horse. When a shell landed on the road, the horse was in front of him, and it absorbed all the shrapnel and saved his life. And he told me that when horses got killed, which happened all the time over there, they had to be buried right away because otherwise the wolves would get at them. And that was really, that was a real brisk wake-up call right there, hearing somebody talk about wolves on the battlefield. That was really something that brought back to me in that moment just how long ago this war was. But I talked to people from every branch of service, Army, Navy, Marine Corps. I spoke to the last survivor of the Battle of Belleau Wood, and in fact, everybody I spoke to was the last survivor of their division. Pretty much every battle represented in America, I spoke to the last survivor of. I even spoke to the last survivor of America's ill-fated Siberian expedition at the end of World War One. And not just soldiers. I spoke to engineers and people who worked in service, driving ambulances. I spoke to a fellow who served in the Balloon Corps. Again, really just a much, much greater pool of experiences than I had a right to expect at the start. I even interviewed three women who'd served in World War One.
The Last of the Doughboys is more than just a simple war story, folks. And as you might guess, with the age of these World War One veterans that Richard Rubin interviewed, we're probably talking about the aging issues and perhaps memory issues here for some of these veterans.
Well, you know, it's a very interesting thing. I went into it thinking that maybe I'd be able to talk to them about stuff they'd done, 5, 10 years earlier, but how could I possibly expect them to remember things that they've done 85, 90 years ago. And in fact, something I learned very early on is that at that age, often memory is a matter of first in, last out. So these folks were able to recall in very vivid detail their experiences in World War One, but they often couldn't tell you what they'd had for breakfast.
just a couple of questions about World War One, and as we mentioned earlier, Richard, you know, by and large, Americans today are far more knowledgeable about World War II than they are about World War One. The United States did not get into World War One at the beginning of the conflict, I don't believe, if I remember my history correctly. We were in it, of course, and lost many, many lives. Did most of the American action in World War One take place in France or in other countries as well?
Yes, Americans served pretty much exclusively in France in World War One. Often alongside French soldiers and French colonial soldiers, it was much less common for Americans to serve alongside British soldiers. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. America did not get into the war until 2.5 years after it started. And the war was very unpopular in this country among a lot of people. It was very controversial. There were a lot of people who were very impatient for America to get into the war, Teddy Roosevelt, perhaps the most notable example, but there were an awful lot of people who wanted to have absolutely nothing to do with it. And so once America got in, that all changed very quickly.
I assume you went to France?
I did go to France, and a lot of people think that the French don't care for Americans, but in the part of France that I spent a lot of time in, which would be the parts that Americans served in, not Normandy, but further east of that, east of Paris, not only do they still have very fond memories of Americans and gratitude to America, because Americans liberated a great many of these towns after 4 years of German occupation in World War One, but a lot of towns have monuments to Americans in World War One. One of the most moving sites I saw was in the French town of Thiaucourt. Their World War One monument, the only World War One monument in the whole town, is a statue of an American soldier and a French soldier shaking hands. Mm. It was really a wonderful thing to behold, and that sentiment is still very, very strong in that part of France. They really do feel, you know, World War One for that part of France was the traumatic event. World War Two, the fighting at least in France, when the Nazis invaded in 1940, was over very quickly, just a matter of weeks. But in World War One, it dragged on for 4 years and really devastated the landscape. There were many towns that were destroyed and never rebuilt. And they give the Americans a lot of credit for driving the Germans out and liberating their towns, and that feeling is still very strong to this day.
Our time begins to run short. Things I learned in reading your book, Richard Rubin. By the way, listeners, again, the title of the book, The Last of the Doughboys. Well, we know that the U.S. Army was still segregated in World War II, so obviously it was in World War One. You have a picture in here of, I'm searching through my notes, the Harlem Hellfighters. Tell us a little bit about the Harlem Hellfighters.
Well, they were the 369th Infantry Regiment, and they were one of the most storied regiments to come out of that war. But as you said, the Army was thoroughly segregated in World War One. Not only segregated, but they really didn't care much for the notion of African American men fighting. 80% of all black soldiers who were sent over to France in World War One were stationed behind the lines and not even issued rifles. But the Harlem Hellfighters were one of a handful of regiments that were actually given over to the French. And so unlike most American soldiers, they fought under French command in French uniforms with French rifles. And the French loved them, and they were quite heroic. And when they came home in, I believe, February of 1919, they were given a big parade in New York and were the first World War One regiment to actually march on parade in the city of New York.
And if someone had asked me when women began to serve in in the U.S. military, I would have said World War II with the waves and the wax and so on and so forth. How surprised was I to find out about a group that I'd never even heard of before, the Yeomanettes, for goodness sakes. They were in the Navy, women in World War I?
That's correct. It was actually a clerical error that enabled them to enlist. There was an act that was passed, I believe, in 1916 that left a loophole in it about the gender of people allowed to enlist in the Navy. It didn't specify that you had to be male. And when somebody brought this up to the Secretary of the Navy, Josephus Daniels, the following year, he decided to just let it stand. And so eventually 11,000 women enlisted in the Navy in World War One. They were called Yeomanettes, as you said, and they did mostly clerical work. But they were official enlisted service women, and it was the first time that any branch of the military gave women that opportunity.
And you have a photograph of eight of them in your book. All sorts of interesting historical tidbits, listeners. If you want to learn more about World War One, and especially if you want to read about these really marvelous stories of World War One veterans interviewed in person, in all cases not long before they died, by Richard Rubin, author of The Last of the Doughboys. I'm assuming that we can find your book in the regular places where we find books these days, Richard?
Everywhere books are sold, yes. And I just want to add that if people are interested in seeing video clips of some of these veterans, some of the interviews I conducted, they can find them at thelastofthedoughboys.com, including an interview with a woman. We were talking about Yeomanettes. I was fortunate to interview two Yeomanettes. Hmm.
Richard Rubin is the author of the best-selling Confederacy of Silence. Is that still available, Richard?
It is.
He's also written for The Atlantic, for The New York Times Magazine, The New Yorker, Smithsonian, Parade, The Sunday Magazine, and many more. And it's been our pleasure to chat with him today. Richard Rubin, the author of The Last of the Doughboys, The Forgotten Generation and Their Forgotten World War. Thanks, Richard. Enjoyed the conversation a great deal. Thanks much.
I did, too. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so long now.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 32-32. The pick 3 is 631-631. The pick 4 is 0247. The pick 5, 36440. The wild ball for each is 3. And the treasure hunt, 5, 12, 16, 21, and 23. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $120,000.
Moving from my home of 50 years was a little scary, but I wasn't safe at home anymore, and my daughter with her busy life, children and grandchildren, it wasn't fair for me to expect so much from her.
We looked together to find a new home and discovered New Haven Court at Clearview.
What made the difference were the employees and the residents we met. The residents said it was a great place to live.
New Haven Court at Clearview, a great place to live because it's a great place to work. 888-261-5753 or visit IntegraCare.com.
Interesting, especially with just last week, President Trump being in France to help mark the 100th anniversary of the United States entry into World War I, 1917. Wow. And what a loss. War only lasted, for us, 2 years, 1917, 1918. And yet, we lost 117,000 men, Americans, lost in World War One. And I learned some things. Most Americans, most of the action for Americans was in France, northwestern France. Richard Rubin, historian, visiting with us. And we certainly thank our earlier guest today, Dr. Dennis Damon. Took a lot of questions about pets, pet health, pet concerns. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll have some open talk time to kick things off. We will also chat tomorrow with Dave Cord. Director Cord is the director of VA Butler Healthcare. We'll get, well, it's probably going to be the final update, right, for the opening of the new VA Butler Healthcare Center out on Duffy Road, the A.B. Abraham VA Healthcare Center. And I think plans have been finalized, too, for an open house when the general public will be able to get to see inside the new building. So we get all the final details on that from Director Cord tomorrow. And also tomorrow, Bob Kerlick visits with us. He is Vice President of Media Relations for the Allegheny County Airport Authority. How about all these new airlines beginning service into Pittsburgh, in and out of Pittsburgh? You can fly direct to Europe again. You can fly to Iceland. You can fly nonstop to Frankfurt, Germany. Charter service to China. What's this all about? Oh, it's pretty neat, actually. We'll talk about that with Bob Kerlick tomorrow. All of that on the Wednesday edition of It's Your Turn. I'm Dave Malarkey. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday. We'll see you tomorrow, 12:30, here on It's Your Turn on WISR, 680 in Butler. Pirate baseball tonight as the Pirates.